You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello and welcome to this podcast, Dosing Strategies and Side Effect Profiles of Third-Line Metastatic Colorectal Cancer Treatment Options. Given the preference of some physicians to utilize chemotherapy-sparing therapies in the third-line setting, and the fact that agents like regorafenib require continuous administration in order to be effective, neo-dosing strategies and proactive management strategies for adverse events are needed to improve tolerability for patients who could benefit from these third-line therapies. Hi, I'm Dr. Shubham Pant, and I'm joined by my colleague, Dr. Jonathan Mizrahi from the Ochsner Medical Center in New Orleans. We will be discussing dosing strategies for and adverse event profiles of available therapies for metastatic colorectal cancer in the third-line setting. Welcome, Dr. Mizrahi.
Thanks. I appreciate you having me on.
So, Jonathan, you know, I know you treat quite a few patients with metastatic colorectal cancer. So first, kind of maybe give me a quick recap of approved treatment options for patients for the third-line therapy. And I'm not talking about targeted therapy. I'm saying, let's say they do not have a G12C or don't have a HER2, don't have a BRAF mutation, right? So this is just patients who don't have that. What are kind of the approved treatment options for third-line therapy? And kind of give me a little bit of flavor of, you know, without going to great detail, about this kind of a little bit of the side effects of the same.
Sure. So, you know, there are a few therapies that we have in this setting that are commonly used in third line that really can be used across patients, no matter their specific molecular profiles, whether they're RAS-RAF mutated or not. So one of those, the one that's been around the longest is regorafenib. So regorafenib, it's a multi-targeted kinase inhibitor. It's an oral therapy. You know, it initially got its approval based on comparison with placebo. It showed that median overall survival was improved with regorafenib versus placebo. So some of the toxicities that we commonly see in the clinic for patients on regorafenib is, I would say the one that stands out the most is probably the hand-foot skin reaction, right? So patients who are getting maybe some tingling, maybe some pain, and even some blistering and swelling of their hands or their feet, maybe between their fingers. We can also see some other on-target effects. You can see fatigue, hypertension, liver enzymes can be elevated as well. As you use this drug, you kind of are used to monitoring these and seeing when they come about and, how to manage those. So we could talk a little bit about that later. Another player in the field is that came along kind of second would be trifluridine tipiracil. So this is kind of an oral fluoropyrimidine agent. And it's basically chemotherapy. So it's a little bit different, obviously, than the IV fluoropyrimidines, but it's similar in mechanism. So the side effect profile that we see with this agent is similar to what we see with chemotherapy. So the main ones, I would say, with the traditional dosing strategy is hematologic toxicity. So, in the initial study where this gained approval in the New England Journal of Medicine, almost 10 years ago now, we saw leukopenia, neutropenia, a little bit of febrile neutropenia, anemia, thrombocytopenia, so these hematologic toxicities. And then because it is a chemotherapy agent, you can still get fatigue, you can still get nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. Those are obviously just a little bit less common than the heme toxicities. And the most recent approval based on the, FRESCO 1 and 2 studies was fruquintinib. So this is an oral VEGF inhibitor. With this oral VEGF inhibitor, you can see, VEGF toxicity. So hypertension, again, the hand-foot skin reaction, diarrhea. I would say of those, probably hypertension is the one we're seeing the most clinically, in treating these patients. But this is kind of a newer agent we're still kind of getting used to and figuring out how to optimally manage these patients.
John, thank you so much. That was a tour de force in the ones that are being treated right now. Tell me a little bit, and we discussed this on the previous podcast, is how do you kind of choose based on previous therapies? So toxicities, you said, let's say you got neutropenia, and how do you kind of look at the previous, or do you look at that, the previous therapies? And this program is for physicians treating patients in Veterans Affairs mostly, who have comorbidities associated with everything else with their disease. So do you look at the previous therapies and look at the tolerance before you kind of say, okay, I'm going to go right or left, or I'm going to take, rego versus TAS-102. Do you use that?
Yeah, I think that's the way you would optimally use it, is really to look at what patients have had before, how they tolerated it, what their current performance status is, what they're currently dealing with side effect wise. You know, if a patient's having recurrent neutropenia, thrombocytopenia, anemia, then, you know, triploridine tapiracil, TAS 102 might be a little bit challenging. You know, it might be something you want to save for a little bit later. If on the other hand, you have a patient who's suffering from fistulas or resistant hypertension, wound healing issues, and, you know, their counts are doing okay, you know, then maybe you might want to use more in the triploridine tapiracil. So I definitely think you should use patients' prior therapies and kind of what they're dealing with currently to make that decision of what you're going to use in the third line.
And the important thing is that one size does not fit all, right? You need to really try to, you know, individualize the therapy to the patient. But tell me a little bit about, you talked about regorafenib and the dosing. And I remember I was as young as you when regorafenib first came out. No, not anymore. I was 20 years old.
The Stone Age? Is that?
So I was as young as you when regorafenib just came out. And I remember treating my first patient with the 160 milligrams. And man, that did not go well. So tell us a little bit about the evolution of treatment of regorafenib in the clinical landscape.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think, you know, since I've been practicing, which is not quite as long as you, though I look like I'm older than you, we have kind of modulated how we're recommending regorafenib dosing. And largely this is based on the REDOS study. So this was a really, I would say, impactful study that was published in 2019. And it was looking at basically a dose escalation strategy when you're initiating patients on regorafenib. So as you mentioned, the standard dosing for regorafenib was first established is using 160 milligrams per day, 3 weeks on and then 1 week off. So for 21 days out of 28 day cycles. And what we found is that, you know, pretty quickly patients can have some difficulty with tolerance, not all patients, but a lot of patients. And it would lead to some frequent early discontinuation. You really weren't maximizing the potential benefit of this drug. So the REDO study looked at a separate escalating dosing strategy. So what they did was you'd be either randomized to getting the standard dosing, as we discussed, versus the escalation, which was 80 milligrams per day for the first week, 120 milligrams per day for the second week, and then moving up to 160, the full dose, in the third week. Obviously, if you tolerate it, you move up each dosing step. If you don't tolerate it, you know, you have the option of keeping at that that dosage that you was the kind of the maximal tolerated dose. What they really looked at in the study was it really wasn't looking at survival necessarily. That was a secondary endpoint, but really the primary endpoint was the percent of patients who completed that second cycle and started the third cycle. So how many patients were they keeping on the treatment for that third cycle? And it was a positive study. So 43% of the patients who were getting that dose escalation strategy were able to start their third cycle, completing the first two, and only 26% of patients in the standard dosing regimen. So really getting those patients third cycle was more likely if you had that dose escalation. Now, they did look at survival, and there was some trend towards an increased overall survival in patients who were on the dose escalation strategy, probably because they had more exposure to the drug, but it wasn't, you know, powered to really assess that as a secondary endpoint. So, you know, I think most of us who use this drug in clinical practice and in the colorectal cancer setting, the third line or beyond, really have established this as our standard way of dosing our patients. So I would say I use this regularly. So I thought this study was really crucial in our management of our patients.
So tell me, John, what about, you know, you mentioned some of the side effects of regorafenib. Even the 80, 120, 160, you do get side effects, right? It's not like you're not getting any side effects. So how do you manage these side effects? So one of the ones you mentioned was, you know, hand, foot, skin reactions and everything. How do you manage, you know, other side effects, which are hypertension and everything, when they're associated with this drug? So come some tips for our physicians.
The most important one, I would say, at getting a look at early and assessing early is that hand-foot-skin reaction. So, you know, it's a little bit different than the hand-foot syndrome we associate with capecitabine and Pfeiffer-Uracil. So, you know, the etiology is a little bit different. So the management's just slightly different. So a lot of it's preemptive in counseling patients, the things to do and don't do. So, you know, avoid high pressure activities on your hands or your feet. I know it's, you know, you're like, well, what can I do then? So not, you know, avoiding kind of long walks and runs, as much as we want our patients to exercise, there are other ways of doing that. You know, we even typing, avoiding real hot water. So taking real hot baths or doing the dishes in hot water can be challenging. If you are going to be walking around a lot, really in general, using real good padding on your shoes. You know, there's also, you know, we recommend patients use a lot of moisturizing lotions, creams, really alcohol-free would be best. These are things patients can do preemptively to try to kind of stave off that hand-foot skin reaction. What I would counsel, you know, providers, oncologists, and nurse practitioners and stuff to do to would be to kind of see these patients pretty early. So for the first, you know, 3-4 weeks, I mean, if you can see them once a week or at least check in with them once a week to see how are you tolerating this? Because, you know, if you say, I'll see you in a month after your first cycle, you know, some of those hand-foot skin reactions get a little bit out of control when you could have caught it a little bit earlier, sooner, providing a little more expectant management. So I would say see these patients early for the first few weeks, and then, you know, frequently for the first few weeks, I should say, and then you could start to spread that out. You know, because it is something that gets better with time. So if you can get them through that first month and definitely through that first 2 months, I think you can really get through it. Now, in terms of the hypertension, you know, this is, again, just something that if you have access to kind of remote monitoring technology, I think that's optimal here. So, you know, we do a lot of that at Ochsner where we kind of send patients home with blood pressure monitoring kits that reports directly to our EMR. Now, I know that's not easily replicable in every setting, but I think counseling patients on getting a home blood pressure cuff, and I imagine the VA has programs to do that, you know, it really does empower the patients to kind of stay on top of it. And then getting that feedback to you so you can really adjust their blood pressure based on their ambulatory pressure. It's not really what you're getting every time they come in the clinic, but what they're doing at home. Those are ones you can really stay on top of.
That's really good. So see them frequently, at least during the first month. I think that's a very, very important tip. If somebody takes one thing back from the podcast, that's it when you start these patients. What about task one or two? You know, what kind of side effects and what do you do about them? Dose adjustments, interruptions, what do you do with task one or two?
Yeah, so task one or two or trifluridine tipiracil. So again, this is, you know, a little bit, you know, it's chemo. So oral chemo. So the standard dosing, I think, is something worth discussing. So standard dosing when this drug came out is you take 35 milligrams per meter squared BID, so 70 milligrams per meter squared daily. And you do that on days 1 through 5, and then you do it again a week later, right? So, you know, you have this, basically you have 2 weeks on, 1 week off. It can be a little bit challenging in terms of the counts when you do it that way. So, you know, there's data coming out from modified dosing strategy. And I think that's probably what I do most frequently is when I start patients on task one or two or trifluridine tipiracil is to use the biweekly dosing. So instead of the day 1 through 5 and 8 through 12 of every 28-day cycle, using this day 1 through 5 and then day 15 through 19 scheduling. So every other week, what you find is that when they come back in for their second dose, particularly if you use it in combination with bevacizumab based on the Sunlight study, you know, it's arranged a little bit better and you don't see a significant of the hematologic toxicities. So you can do dose reductions if you need to, obviously manage their nausea. If that's a problem, it's not as big of a problem as it is for the, you know, intravenous fluoropyrimidine and capecitabine, but definitely can occur. But I would say those hematologic toxicities can be pretty manageable if you use that biweekly dosing schedule.
That's fantastic, John. I think that's very important. Now we can dose change a little bit. Now, quickly before, you know, we just have about a couple of minutes. What about the new kid on the block, right? Fruquintinib. Do you use the same strategy? I know it's just got approved. So tell us a little bit about, you know, what you're using. Are you seeing it's the same? Or do you think you can use the same dose, which is approved right now?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, I think I'm still getting my hands dirty with it to try to see what the optimal approach is. Right now, you know, I've been using just the standard 5 milligram dose for all my patients, you know, 21 days on, 7 days off, you know, adjusting as needed, you know, dose reduce if you need to. There was a small study that was done in Chinese patients where they looked at like elderly patients and tried to do a dose escalation strategy, similar to redose. And what they found is actually it was kind of hard to dose escalate some of those patients. So, you know, maybe some data will come out in the future that maybe we should try that dose escalation strategy. But I've had fairly good success. Again, with close monitoring, I think of the hypertension being the primary thing I would point home here. We see a lot of that with the fruquintinib. It's starting at the 5 milligram dose, but knowing that, you got to stay on top of these patients' blood pressures and as the primary adverse effect to be keeping in mind.
Well, thank you so much, John. That's all the time we have for today. I want to thank Dr. Mizrahi for sharing his insights and experience with us regarding how to use dose modifications and proactive management strategies to improve efficacy and quality of life for patients undergoing third-line therapy for metastatic colorectal cancer. And thank you to our listeners for joining us. We hope you will listen to the second episode of this series. This podcast was brought to you by Med Learning Group. Med Learning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. The CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. A special thank you to our supporter, Bayer Healthcare Pharmaceuticals Incorporated, who provided an educational grant for this activity. Thank you so much.